Ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues, some 10 years ago, in the Cambridge History of 20th Century Music, Richard II inserted in his chapter on the avant-garde of the 1960s and 70s a short excursion titled New National Schools. It is indeed a quite perplexing excursion. In three paragraphs, it aims at illustrating the worldwide influence of avant-garde in this period by cursory mentioning of some countries and some composers. In the first paragraph, two premises that the Darmstadt triumvirate of the 1950s, Boulez, Murnau, Stockhausen, international as it was, actually represented the countries that had dominated 19th century music, France, Italy, and Germany. After the loosening of socialist-realist stylistic restrictions, says Du, Eastern European countries like Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Yugoslavia joined this traditional core. And then he suddenly adds Cuba, represented by Leo Brueghel. The second paragraph is devoted to England, with Peter Maxwell Davies, Harrison Birtwistle, and other members of the Manchester School, a country that hardly can be referred to as Terry Farrell, least so in a Cambridge history. And finally, Du offers a glimpse of the Far East, of Japan with Toru Takemitsu and Korea with Zhang Yun, stressing how these composers aimed to intermingle Western avant-garde techniques with the musical tradition of their homeland. Even if Du meticulously couples nations and composers' names, he cautiously remarks that, I quote, "These modernist schools provided a major revitalization of national musical culture, though rarely in a nationalist sense." End quote. Reading Du's obviously very condensed list of national schools from the Hungarian perspective is certainly disappointing. Not only because Hungary remains unmentioned, but also because Hungarian historiography has cherished the illusion that this very period of the 60s and 70s saw the flourishing of a new Hungarian school that not only existed, but it was perceivable even from an outsider's view. Du's neglecting of it is a painful evidence that this belief has proven to be a mere illusion from the distance of only some decades. My paper aims to examine the historical roots, the formation, the validity, and the dissolution of this illusion. The storytelling can hark back to a century earlier, when in 1861, the composer Mihai Moshagi assigned his fellow composer the ambitious task, I quote, "through an artistic development of Hungarian music to create beside, please note, German, Italian and French style, and school a fourth internationally renowned musical idiom, namely the Hungarian." The problem Hungarian composers faced in fulfilling this mission was quite similar as in other countries of the European periphery in the same period. The basis of the longed-for national music rooted in the Gebrauchsmusik of the specific country that was not easy to adjust to the Western genres that emerged in very different. The claim of co-equality of the Hungarian musical idiom, however, included a claim of being perceived. And this claim has accompanied Hungarian music history since then. The adept chronicler of the Hungarian Romantic music, Bence Szabolcsi, must have acknowledged that the great ambitions were doomed to failure. However, as he noticed, this failure led to the emerging of a new generation in the early 20th century. Szabolcsi, who in 1917 became Zoltán Kodály's pupil in composition at the Budapest Music Academy, accompanied with his writings the way of this new generation, that is, of Kodály and Béla Bartók. When in 1922 he first served his master with his pen, two facts seemed already positive. First, that Hungarian music has finally found its own voice, and second, that this voice has been perceived by outsiders' ear as a distinct way of self-expression of a nation. This can be proven by the fact that Savoy's publication on Kodály's instrumental music appeared in Musikblätter des Anbruch, in the periodical of the Viennese Universal Edition that became the propagator of the two Hungarian composers towards other countries. It was just self-evident that two decades later, in 1940, when Savoy summarized his encyclopedic knowledge in the Universal History of Music, the last pages, like an apotheosis, offer a double portrait of the two Hungarian geniuses. Here Savoy underlines the common roots of their musical language, namely their Hungarian folk music, but he ascribes the true effect of their music to more essential characteristics. I quote, "For Western ear, the material of this language," writes Savoy, "the pentatonic melody might have been astounding, but it was more than that. In first place, a deep, strong, unveiled, almost primordial closeness to life, death, and nature that diffused from Hungarian compositions and that appeared more innovative for the exhausted nerves of the West than anything, more innovative than the barbarism of Stravinsky, because it was more truthful. It came from deeper, from a greater distance, but indeed from closer," end quote. If you hear the rhetoric of this torrent of words, the underlying idea is a claim of supremacy on the basis of preserving a prehistoric heritage of the mankind, as also as newcomers being more faithful to the European truths than the Europeans themselves. This lofty idea is worth mentioning because it returns in a milder form in the 1960s in the confrontation of Hungarian and Western music. Also remarkable is the stitch toward the rival Stravinsky, whom, at another place, Savoy compares to Meyerbeer. The declaration of Hungarian values and the defamation of those who follow different ideals also proved to be a recurrent element of the later discourse. We have Bartók, and it means a lot. That's how a young composer student began his report on new Hungarian music for the German periodical Melos in 1949. It was the 26 years old György Ligeti who formulated this enthusiastic exclamation. One asked himself whether he was then aware of the ambiguity of his statement. 10 years later, already as an emigre, Ligeti complained about the wall of China atmosphere and the provincialism of Hungarian music life in the Stalinist era. Actually, this provincialism had its antecedent in the pre-war period, when due to the overwhelming influence of Bartók and Kodály, many young composers were satisfied with copying their models and acquired an idiom then rooted in Hungarian folk music, but had not much to do with life, death, and nature. Hence, contrary to Ligeti's statements, it was not Bartók, but only elements of his and Kodály's style that determined Hungarian music of the 1940s and 50s. No doubt, this music sounded flawlessly Hungarian, but it rarely outgrew the level of epigonism. According to the later coined term, this kind of folkloristic national classicism can be recognized on its highest level, actually, in the Serenade for Strings by Serbansky from in a series of articles they sought to demonstrate that their style is built on folk music, therefore they cannot be charged as formalists. The fate of the Savasky Serenade fittingly illustrates the quick changes of tidings in the following years. 1949, at its premiere, it was hailed even by the actual Soviet guest, Mikhail Chunaki, as a piece that exemplary conforms to principles of the party decree. 2 years later, at a festival in 1951, another Soviet guest, this time Kirill Grenikov, praised a freshly premiered folk song cantata by Servansky and confronted it with the serenade that he unexpectedly doomed as a formalist aberration. Then in 1955, when Servansky appeared with a tragically tuned orchestral concerto, clearly modeled after Bartok's concerto, the reviews recalled the simpler musical style of the serenade as an evidence that Servansky earlier could follow the right path. Personal intrigues disguised as political controversies, rising and fall of mediocre talents according to the will of not even mediocre party functionaries, outcasting, treason, and flexion of weaker or stronger souls. The 7 years between 1949 and 1956 offer abundant narrative material for historiography. But all these remain an interior affair that, tragic as it is, might have occurred quite similarly in any other Eastern European country as well. Similarly uniform was the isolation from the West, where simultaneously a new wave of avant-garde was nascent. It was likewise no Hungarian peculiarity that the music was partly cut from its own past. While Bartók remained an official label of Hungarian music, many of his compositions became victims of a censorship that tried to spare the working class from the allegedly bourgeois influence. There was no more words of life, death, and nature. The nation stayed lonely in space and time. After 1956, things have gradually changed. A new generation of composers in their 20s and 30s suddenly recognized that the technical knowledge they acquired is far from being up to date, that composition outside Eastern Europe means something different than what they thought it to be. A phase of quick learning began, although the curriculum proved to be quite extensive. The level of time was to be reached in an era when, in the Western European avant-garde, serialism, sonorism, aleatory electroacoustic music, special instrumental and vocal techniques, and happening coexisted. The learning happened through sporadically purchased scores and recordings, occasional visits at festivals in Warsaw and or Darmstadt, for the few most fortunate ones through longer study trips. The results appeared quite fast. The milestones that everybody finds in historical accounts of this period are 6 orchestral pieces by Edle Servansky, premiered in 1959, and György Kurdák's String Quartet, premiered in 1961. The resistance of the politics against innovative tendencies quickly vanished. Servansky's composition, a strictly dodecaphonic cycle with a first movement instrumented solely for percussion, generated a mixed critical echo, but the stature of the composer and his old communist past saved him from stronger repression. And when Kurdák presented his String Quartet to the jury of the Cultural Ministry, one of the composer members indignantly declared he had written a dissident music that is against the regime. This accusation, however, did not hinder the work to be presented 1963 in Copenhagen and 1964 in Paris as official representative of new Hungarian music. Cultural policy soon realized that musical innovations scarcely convey oppositional messages, so there was no need to intervene directly, like in the case of literature, theater, or movie. The James faced the nation. The nature of this learning phase can also be illustrated by a third composer, Rudolf Marosch, whose Chick Vestudimer Orchestra were premiered in 1960. The alternation of slow and fast movements, notturni and scherzi, made clear the study character of the work. The first notturno experiments in fine woodwind colors and the more traditional material, set for strings, that reminds Bartók's development. From the mid-60s on, more and more opportunities were offered for younger Hungarian composers to present themselves on the international stage. This period was insofar auspicious that the receptiveness of Western institutions to Eastern European cultural products was obviously expanding. In England, Boosey and Hoax distributed scores of Editio Musica, hence its periodical tempo often advertised and reviewed works of Hungarian composers. In addition, between 1962 and 71, its editor-in-chief was Colin Mason, who in the late 40s studied in Budapest with Szervánszky and showed constant sympathy towards Hungarian music. The most influential Hungarian music critic, György Krew, in many senses the successor of Bence Szabolcsi, yearly presented broadcast recordings of new Hungarian compositions at the International Rostrum of Composers in Paris. That some of these compositions were elected among their recommended works during the 60s, and that in 1970, 72, and 75, pieces from Hungary were awarded the title of selected work, were recorded with great enthusiasm. Krew himself spoke of a triumphal march of Hungarian music, and he sought to recognize its reason in an international trend of the early 70s that, I quote, measures and compels each composition through its idea, emotional world, and the quality of its poetic content, and not through the unsettled innovative aspirations of the actual avant-garde, end quote. To say it short, Krew feared a new era to come, where closeness to life, death, and nature would determine the value of art again. And he also felt that this situation could be advantageous for Hungarian composers because they had never sacrificed expression on the altar of technique. It is in fact remarkable that while Krew and his Hungarian critic colleagues have always hailed the capacity of Hungarian composers to adopt coloristic and textural techniques from their Western contemporaries, they often neglected or simply overlooked their inclination to stricter musical logic, as if it would be a hindrance of free expression. The critics repeatedly mentioned dodecaphony as a warrant for modernism, but usually mean a free atonality that is not bound by the strict rules of Schönberg and his successors. For example, the Hungarian author of one of the first longer the first longer article on Gerd Kurtág declares that in Kurtág's art, I quote, dodecaphony is one of the main regulatory force, but not in the sense as in Schönberg or Weber, but in a free, free, unorthodox manner. End quote. It is almost ironic that this sentence is illustrated in the article by a musical example taken from the fifth movement of the aforementioned string quartet, one of the few but still existing pieces by Kortár that is built on a dodecaphonic row. My next example from the burial prayer of Joel Turco similarly does not intend to display the technical knowledge of its author. However, Turco's oratorio, a setting of the oldest coherent text in Hungarian from the late 12th century, readily intimates its country of origin through its melodic formulas. These epitomize one of the favorite intonation of Hungarian composers, the lament. Many examples can be cited to illustrate a wide vocal and instrumental variety of similar spell-instrumented melodies with an initially narrow, then gradually extended tessitura. Obviously, this kind of music could count on the interest of an international audience, since Burial Prayer was awarded selected work at the Paris Rostrum in 1975 with an overwhelming majority. Hungary gradually disappeared from the international stage of new music. Some outstanding personalities like Kortár or Peter Ötvös are continuously there and are perceived as of Hungarian origin, even if most of them have lived abroad for decades. Is it not so that the national schools are not more than a rain car that protects limitedly autonomous talents? That not a crew bound by common nation, but only great personalities can sustain a wide and durable